Stony Brook, long, long time ago, 1981 or something, I happened to meet Hans Bethe and asked him, well, what important problems should I work on? You know, everybody's, they were all working on supernovae at the time. And I said, well, Prakash, take one problem at a time that you can do, then go to the next one, and then go to the next one, and that's the only way to work. So I simply wandered into neutron stars without ever realizing I would be doing it. So I'll tell you a little bit about what I've learned since then. And I don't know. Depends, right? Some people have extreme passions and that they pursue. Others do what they can. Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to focus today on is the importance of masses and radii of neutron stars. So most of my talk will be talking about just masses and radius and why such an emphasis on them. And issues posed by recent observations and the need for further observations to get ahead in life. So I'll say a little bit about mass measurements, most of which you probably know better than I do, but I'll try to keep it as simple as possible for those who don't always delve into this. And now there are two cases as opposed to, let's say, 2 years of extremely well-measured two solar mass neutron stars. The first by the Scott Ransom and Company group, and the second, I think it also involves them. Ingrid Stairs is my connection with this from University of British Columbia, who keeps me updated on all the more recent mass measurements. And then I'll introduce the notion of maximally compact neutron stars. This much and no more kind of scenario, 0-1 situation. It cannot be any less than this, it cannot be any more than this. And this is not going to be an equation of state that nuclear theorists would be proud of, because it sort of sets an upper limit for them. They have to lie under it, of course, but it sort of gives them where they should not go. It sort of sets out the territory in which you should move. And you learn quite a bit from it, because it is entirely analytical in some sense. Having done one calculation, scaling properties of the GR equations, talking classical GR, Einsteinian GR at the moment only. Scaling relations for the masses and radii with respect to elemental parameters of the maximally compact neutron star equation of state can be immediately inferred. This teaches us a lot. And it also begs the question of what are the limits to the extent of hyperons. They are strangeness-bearing baryons in the particle data book, and kaon condensates. Kaon is a boson. It also is strange in its nature. And whenever the electron chemical potential in the system becomes of order the kaon mass in the medium, then a kaon condensate can appear in the system. And condensates generally tend to soften the equation of state. Similarly, the appearance of quarks and so forth in the interiors of neutron stars were thought to soften the equation of state, but you know those notions are being revised even as we speak. And then I'll talk about something what I termed as the ultimate energy density of a cold observable matter, achievable only in neutron stars. By this I mean, I think I've chosen the words carefully. Have I said cold? Yeah, cold observable matter. So I've excluded black holes from this category. And then, for me, the most important thing is we have to become earnest about measuring radii of neutron stars to the same accuracy that binary pulsar measurements of masses have been made, at least in some cases. Without which we cannot take leaps in our understanding, at least of the interacting interactions that occur between the constituents of a neutron star. At the moment, only radius estimates exist.
Yeah.
Black holes are observable in an indirect sense, and they do not tell me much about their interior. My focus is on the strong interactions here. Okay? So what can I learn about high density interacting matter that I cannot learn from laboratory experiments? Let me put it that way. Okay? At the moment, current estimates of radii exist, but as I said, accurate measurements do not exist. And I'm pushing anybody and anybody that I can find who will listen to me to go after them. And even devise means to measure radii very accurately, at least as accurately as masses have been measured. And then what kind of a model independent step can we take in order to determine the equation of state of matter, namely the relationship between pressure and energy density within a star? So that's roughly the outline. So let me give you some basic examples of why mass and radii are so important. The first is the binding energy of the neutron star itself as it is formed in the wake of a core collapse supernova. So it's approximately given by the formula that I've shown. The terms in parentheses arise mostly because of GR corrections. The rest is essentially Newtonian physics of an isolated object. And the important point is that nearly 99% of this energy is already emitted in the form of neutrinos. And this is observable in the case that you have a supernova explosion, especially in the case even mass estimates have been made, in fact, first performed by Bethe himself, in the case of the supernova 1987A. And the mass limit for that was set at 1.6 solar masses. And now we have all these neutrino detectors in place, including Sudbury, where they have again started working, Super Kamiokande, many others. And now we are in a position of the detector sensitivities are such that we'll be able to see 10,000s of neutrinos as opposed to a handful 8 that we saw in the case of supernova 1987A. That's exciting. Should one occur, not too far away, not too near, within our own galaxy. Second, this is also a very interesting property of a neutron star. This is the limiting frequency of rotation. The Keplerian frequency is just when the particle is shed at the equator upon rotation. However, the Chandrasekhar-Schultz instability due to general relativity sets a little earlier, but not too much to worry about it. So, you know, 10% level or something like that. So in numbers, it's on the order of, let's say, 10 to the 4 times the formula that I've given there. Something is wrong? No, it's okay. I think I've... I think the R max should be minus 3/2, not plus 3/2. Okay? Sorry about that. And the interesting thing about this is it is not yet known if this limiting frequency has been seen in observations. Somehow there seems to be a wall, and it doesn't come. I don't know if you, any of you remember that a 0.5 millisecond neutron star was purported to see, have been seen, soon after supernova 1987A. And we all wrote, you know, very learned papers about what it means for the equation of state of matter at the time. And then they retracted it, and it turns out that the 0.5 millisecond report was because of some interference from a nearby television, which I didn't even know this, that the rate at which the images on the television are scanned in front of our eyes is 0.5 millisecond. Okay? We were devastated, or quite a few of us were devastated that this half a millisecond pulsar was not there in a supernova. To this day, a neutron star has not been seen, which is really impressive in a sense. So anyway, we don't know why that is happening. The other thing is moments of inertia. Again, goes like mr squared with the GR corrections in the denominator. It would be very hard to make it happen. It's about 1.236, something like that. It's significantly higher than that. Okay. If you think in terms of physical equations of state that we know about, it will be very hard to make a 0.5 millisecond star. You can do it, but you have to contrive it. Okay. Not that it bothers people; they do it anyways. But if you want to be, you know, honest about it, it smells strange. Then a particle at the equator shuts itself off. This is not even in classical laboratory physics. So, especially in nuclear physics, you know, you can make a nucleus rotate or acquire angular momentum to very high values of angular momentum, even 70 h-bars. Okay, the famous Dawsbury dizzy nuclei or something like that. But after that, the nuclei begins to lose its identity and particles are being evaporated. Okay, the very same thing happens even in classical physics. It doesn't have to be a quantum system. Okay, so then moments of inertia, and it's possible that you can be in a position to measure the moment of inertia of a neutron star in the case of a binary, double binary neutron star system. But very accurate pulse timing techniques are required for that, and I know that the Princeton group is trying very hard, and the NRAO group are trying very hard to do so. And that will give you some sense of what the radius of a neutron star is. These are the few examples in which mass and radii feature rather prominently and in simple terms. Only the global properties of the system. And there are many other examples, but this will suffice for now. So I won't bore you with this, except to point out that the physical, in terms of strong interaction physics, ingredients of the structure equations are simply the relationship between pressure and energy density at every location in the star. And I'll give you some simple examples of what the consequences are. Again, the binding energy has some significance for us because of what is the most that you can have in terms of, let's say, when I go to the maximally compact equations of state, therefore I define it for completeness sake. Okay. So this is my diagram that I always love to show in front of my Italian friends. You won't catch my Italian friends eating a pizza with many things on it. They just want one ingredient, right? But the possibilities within the core of a neutron star are many, okay? They're all very exciting in terms of the physics that goes with it, but none has been confirmed. As I said before, you can have Bose condensates, you can have quarks within, because if you think about compressing matter to very high densities, then the quarks that make up the nucleons or other constituents such as bosons will begin to lose their own individual identity and begin to sort of roam free even though interacting within the star. So you have to entertain the possibility that quarks, the ultimate constituents of matter, do exist within those stars. So we'll talk a little bit about it and the extent to which this kind of matter can be tolerated, or can they be tolerated at all within neutron stars. Who recognized this phase? I was told by a psychologist from Britain that you should always show a face to audiences that makes them calm, relaxed. I'm trying that, but with a twist to it, saying, do you recognize this face? Say it again. Hey, man. I'm glad I didn't offer you $2 like I did yesterday. This is Don McLean, and the connection is the American Pie, the song. Good for you. Some of them do. Okay, so how do we start thinking about it? The structure of the star is such that it contains a crustal surface electrons and nuclei, drip neutrons are set in a lattice, so there is a lot of condensed matter physics involved there. And you can also have new phases. There goes my Italian friends. That's called the pasta phase, in which you can have lasagna, spaghetti, meatballs, all sorts of phase objects formed because of the interplay between attractive nuclear interactions and the repulsive Coulomb interactions. Coulomb interactions are sort of frustrated in such a setting. So that part is low density physics, not much of strong interaction physics. It's Coulomb interaction physics. So that's electromagnetism. So we sort of know it. And with much help from our condensed matter colleagues, we can even calculate the energetics to a reasonably good accuracy in that phase. It's the liquid solid core that is of some concern, because non-perturbative treatments of strong interactions currently do not exist. They do exist at finite temperature, an impressive achievement, a 2D force achievement from lattice gauge calculations, as long as there are no finite baryon numbers. You might have baryons, but you might have exactly equal number of anti-baryons so that the net baryon number is zero. So at finite temperature, you can make lattice gauge calculations very well founded, and you have even seen phase transitions and experiments involving relativistic heavy ion collisions, both at Brookhaven, at RIC at Brookhaven and LHC at CERN, provided ample evidence that such a phase transition takes place. But the same does not apply for finite density matter, low temperature finite density matter, because lattice gauge calculations cannot be performed in the way that it is performed at finite temperatures, simply because they are Monte Carlo type calculations, and then you need probability densities. And when you go to finite densities, you get determinants occurring in front of it that have a complex nature to it, and complex probabilities do not make much sense. So nothing has been done. So at this point in time, we are sort of stuck with model building in terms of strong interactions. Hence the interest in the interiors of neutron stars from observational point of view. What can it tell us? How can it constrain us? So what are the basic constraints? Baryon number conservation, even if Tuft tells us that proton can decay, but not on these time scales. Charge neutrality, as many positive particles as negative particles in the system. And energy conservation. That means that any weak interactions can take place on the time scales of all the time scales of the life of a neutron star. So all these particles can go through weak interactions. Strangeness is not also conserved, because they also can go through weak interactions. So, however, you need only to watch one or two chemical potentials because of these basic conservation laws. If it is charged, you just watch the electron chemical potential, and every other negatively charged particle can be related to it. And if it is baryon number, you just watch what the neutron chemical potential is doing, namely in your calculations, and then you can trace every other chemical potential because of these three conditions. So in terms of organizing your thought, this is fairly under good control. But you don't know that these particles exist. You still need models for that. So I give you a very simple example, assuming that only nucleons exist, namely neutrons, protons, and their associated leptons that come through weak interactions, electrons and muons. So at the very top, yeah. Correct. No. You can do it for even interacting. Yeah. Very, very clearly. Hugenholtz von Hoff theorem clearly gives us protection in the sense that the chemical potential is simply the value of the single particle energy within a system, but that single particle energy of an interacting system. It need not be that of a non-interacting system. Yeah, even in the average sense, then it is okay. The only problem is how well can you do your strong neuron acting theory or models. For nuclei, we are under fairly good under control. Nuclear densities and the properties of nuclei, even in full glory, such as there are collective excitations, etc. But now we are talking significantly higher densities than nuclear densities. Oh, as I said before, because of these, they're all connected, right? Let's take the case in which I have some hyperons, lambda particles. So all neutron particles must have the same chemical potential, okay? And if I take a negatively charged particle, say cascade minus, it is equal to mu n plus mu e. So that is the very general equation that relates the chemical potentials of any number of particles within the system. So that's what makes this tractable. Okay, so here I've schematically illustrated the energy per particle as a function of baryon number density in units of nuclear density. This is where nuclei exist. And neutron star densities would be somewhere here, okay, 4 to 5, 3 to 4, depending upon the equation of state. And x equal to 0 represents a proton, x is proton fraction. That means this is pure neutron matter. This is equal numbers of neutrons and protons. And because of charge neutrality and weak decay processes, I must have the proton fraction adjusts itself. This is a calculable object. It's not like I have to guess it because of the conservation laws that I had before. And this is the pressure of matter as a function of the baryon compression ratio. Okay, you just take the appropriate derivative here and that curve is what you get. This is what enters this curve and that curve, what enters the structure. So that's my input, given an approach to the strong neuron acting model. Consequences, some examples. The important point here is any two variables, observable variables here, will allow me to get back to the pressure versus energy relation, energy density relationship. So I've picked up the causal limit here, P equal to epsilon. Highly impossible to achieve in interacting matter. It must be very, very peculiar a situation in which this happens. And I've picked two equations of state, one for which the pressure is higher at a given density than the other. I will term this as the stiff equation of state and the one that lies below here as the soft equation of state, just terminology. Here is the low density part, electromagnetic physics. So I'll keep them the same for both of those super density equations of state that differ in their relationships. So here are the predictions from the structure equations, mass versus radius for these two cases. Stiffer the equation of state, higher the mass, and then in the relative to that of the soft equation of state. Again, mass versus density. Here is the binding energy for the two cases. That's important because that's an observable. Moment of inertia, another observable. Redshift at the surface, that's observable, and that involves both the mass and radii. I'm only concentrating on mass and radii here. If I'm able to observe a line on the top of a neutron star, then I have some handle on the redshift itself. And therefore, I can get back to the pressure and energy density. This is a simple illustration of how the mass within the star itself is built up, depending upon different choices of equations of state. So I've illustrated here what the various masses and the central densities of those stars are. Central density is never an observable. It's not possible to observe the central density. The radius is. And the same kind of, say it again. X-axis was these. The radius at a given density, sorry, the density at a given radius divided in terms of the nuclear matter density. Okay? So think of simply as the density. So the same thing illustrated in terms of the pressure versus energy density relationship on by looking at the mass versus radius thing. Notice one thing, and I'll come back to this and harp on this a bit, because this is what enables us to implement a model independent scheme to determine from observations alone this relationship given data on this relationship. Okay? So I'll come back to this again, as I said before. No, pressure at every location in the star. Pressure at a given energy density in units of the saturation density. That's what I'm showing here. So, okay, let's see. Okay, a given star has a structure, right? So if I were to plot the full structure of the star, I would have the mass density or the number density, if you wish, as a function of radius. So it behaves something like that, and that is your radius, right? The pressure here, et cetera, would be highly different. At the edge of the star, the pressure is zero. So for each of those cases, you would have a corresponding energy density. That's what I'm showing on the left-hand side, pressure as a function of energy density. The right-hand side is the given that pressure versus energy density relationship, I can make that using the structure equations and plot it as a function of mass versus radius instead of. So to make the point even more clear, if I pick, let's say this mass, this is my observed mass, okay, that itself would have a structure like this, right? And if I pick a higher one, it would have yet another structure, and so forth. Okay. So we sort of spent quite a few years on collecting all sorts of interaction models and produced mass versus radius curves. And this was the one that was reported in 2007. Why did we do this? This was Hans Bethe's centennial volume. Depending upon the equation of that you choose, lots and lots of mass versus radius curves can be. You concentrate only on these cases first, the dark cases. For example, this one has a Kaon condensate in it. And I mentioned before that if you have a condensate, Bose condensates, most of the particles are in their ground state, momentum zero state, right? Therefore, there is no pressure arising from it, because you need finite momentum states in order to exert pressure. And similarly, this would have some other sort of exotica, and so on and so forth. The point to take from this is the radii that are predicted from these interacting models differ significantly, right? Sometimes even 4 kilometers, let's say, if I pick a 12-kilometer star. The masses also differ very significantly, right? So it already shows you that theory is not under control. Ideas abound, but you know, that's okay. We are here to explain nature, not to at least I'm here to explain nature, and not to tell nature which of these curves it should follow. It does what it does at this point in time. So this was the first indication that something needs to be done. And there are some strict theoretical limits that you can established by all the stalwarts in the game. Pure GR simply tells you that the radius must be greater than 2 GM over C squared, one limit. Then the pressure must be finite within the star, gives you another limit that R is greater than 9/4 of GM upon C squared, established by Weinberg, if I recall right. Causality tells you that it must be greater than 2.9 GM over C squared. All of these are good upper bounds, But in terms of the observations that are at hand, they're totally useless. They're so far away. So it doesn't help us a whole lot. We'll come to that. Yeah, we'll come to that. I'll spend a bit of time on causality. But you know, if a star is here, causality bound is way out there. Okay. But what it tells me is that I can't lie anywhere here. Okay. My non-acting model should not produce me a star that goes in here, and the maximum mass lies in this region. Right. So this is the current status of all mass measurements so far. And the color scheme was mine, together with Jim Latimer, gold-plated, double neutron star binary systems, silver-plated. These come from white dwarf and neutron star binaries. And these are X-ray binaries. And you can see, even at a glance, you can see which one is doing better in terms of accuracy. The X-ray binaries have quite large error bars associated with it. And these are all one sigma error bars. It's important to realize. Some are better than others, but by and large, if you look at this, they are pretty bad. Okay? Compared to the binary pulsar measurements, you know, the famous Hulse-Taylor pulsars, and you see how little they are. Some of these, the mass measurements are, the accuracies of them are better than the accuracy with which we know the gravitational constant. That's impressive, right, if you think about it. And now, more recently, there are cases that are coming in the white dwarf neutron star binaries that are also pretty accurate. No, you actually measure masses. Don't measure GM. I'll tell you how it is possible to measure. I'll show you how it is possible to get it. That such accurate measurements are possible in binary systems. No. Oh, we are measuring GM. I'm sorry. Oh, I thought you meant MR. No. But if I take G as it is given in the particle data book, okay, and then I look at the error bars, then I begin to think, oh. Ultimately, yes. Okay, why is it possible? This you probably already know, but I'll just go through it very quickly because I'm posing this as a challenge to observers to devise similar schemes to measure M and R simultaneously. And I think it is coming. I think it is coming from Strohmeyer at whatever, but he doesn't have proof yet. So in the case of binary systems, you have at least five Keplerian orbital parameters that can be measured very precisely. And I've listed them here. The period, the projection of the pulsar semi-axis on the line of sight, AP sine I, the eccentricity, time to periastron, and the longitudinal of the periastron. And there are several functions that you can form through a combination of the masses of the companions and the observable parameters. And the mass function is the most famous one in the cases of binaries. What I want you to focus on is the different powers that you see on the masses in most of the relationships. They're all very different. And that's what makes this double binary system an overdetermined system in a sense. In addition, you have general relativistic effects. The first one is the advance of the periastron of the orbit. In this case, the power of the mass is 2/3. Combined effects of variation in the Doppler shift and the gravitational redshift, it's sort of quadratic. No, there is another m to the 4/3, so 2 − 4/3. And orbital period decay, that has yet another particular form of the mass dependence. Shapiro delays, mostly determined by the companion mass, in special cases, because if the angles are such that if it's edge on, then you get very lucky. then it is mostly determined by the mass. And I'll give you a table that I pulled out of Scott Ransom soon after he announced the 1.97 solar masses of all the measured Shapiro delays. And the amplitude of the Shapiro delay, I already show it here, that it's for adjoint configurations is essentially determined by the companion mass and the inclination angle. And the inclination angle in this particular case is such that it's very nearly one. So this was the mass measurement in the case of the two solar mass star. And here is what I meant. Sinai is 0.3984. That's how adjoint it was. But you know this. This is a simple schematic diagram of the same. And that's their measurement in this particular case, where the absolute the Shapiro delay itself is measured. And here is the table of all the measured Shapiro delays to date. Took quite a while to get this table. I called him up at 12 o'clock at night. And he had to talk to the Australians, Manchester and company, to get this table for me. Previously. Yeah, the y-axis is the measured, these are all timing, it's not the flux, it's the number of counts and timing offset in a certain particular way. Yeah. What they quote is this peak to valley ratio. That's what they call as the Shapiro delay. This is the phase, that's the time. So in this, the full Shapiro delays measured are here, in this particular column, as they depend upon the pulsar mass and the companion mass and the inclination itself. But as I said before, the simple formula that I gave you before, that essentially most of it is controlled by the inclination angle and the companion mass, you get very nearly the same answers here, just to get going. This sort of helps them in scouting out which object they should focus on with better accuracy. So in radio astronomy, flux is not as important as the time of arrival of the pulses themselves. Of course, if you have a strong signal, it is very good, right? But their entire strength lies in the timing analysis of pulse shapes. No, they're sensitive to the flux, but the information that they get out from their flux measurements, etc., is not from the amplitude of the fluxes, but from the timing differences and the phase differences with respect to time. Okay? Whereas in X-rays, the absolute flux measurement is important, and in some particular cases also the timing, because you can make also pulse shape analysis of the X-ray pulses. But radio is slightly different, or so they tell me. Okay, let me get on to establishing limits now. So let's backtrack, forget about strong interaction physics for a while, and let's make the simplest model possible. One thing we know, that the most compact and massive configuration occur when the low density equation of state is very soft and the high density equation of state is very stiff, that we learned from experience before. So let's make the low density equation where the pressure is zero up to your transition energy density. Now completely go bananas. And make the high density equation of state entirely causal. In other words, dp by d epsilon, which is the square of speed of sound, is unity. And the simplest function you can think of is a linear function. Right? And Ed Wheaton noticed, when he wrote this paper on cosmological separation of phases, some, scaling properties with such an equation of state when you insert them into the structure equations. And that's what we are going to rely on in establishing generic properties. Notice that the solutions scale only with respect to one parameter. There is only one parameter in this equation of state, the transition energy density, as it stands. So that begins to give us some indication of what is what. And we will improve upon this in a while. So you can get your extreme properties of neutron stars. Everything can be worked out, almost analytically. Not these numbers. That requires the calculation for one calculation only. So the maximum mass simply turns out to be 4.1 times square root of the energy density in this particular form. Epsilon S is the energy density of some fiducial energy density of nuclear matter density. But the real solution must depend only upon epsilon naught. That was the only parameter in the equation of state. So it depends as inverse 1/2 power of epsilon naught. So the baryon mass, similarly so, yet another number. The radius is, this was the one that we talked about, 2.82 gm upon c squared, because that was the causal limit. You remember I had put that up before. And this is somewhat important for people who do quark physics. The baryon chemical potential turns out to be a number that is independent of everything else, and that's only 2.1 GeV. And when we saw this number, the people who do perturbative QCD calculations were in deep shock, because they were merrily going doing perturbative calculations. And perturbative calculations are only valid at extremely on the order of 100 GeVs. Whereas in the insides of the maximally compact neutron star that I can construct, the chemical potential is only of order 2.1 GeV. So you can kiss that one goodbye, the perturbative calculations. And similarly, the energy density, pressure at the center, the baryon density, the binding energy, the period of the fastest, whatever, what it must be greater than, and so on and so forth, can be worked out rather quickly. So this is what I call as the extreme properties of neutron stars with a completely causal equation of state after a certain transition density, if matter were only made out of nucleonic stars. Well, at this point, the equation of state doesn't know what it is made out of, right? It just knows that there's a really linear relationship. So if you play the same game, if you stick in 1/3 in front of that linear relationship, then dp by d epsilon is 1/3, that is Cs squared is 1/3, that is the equation of, that is the sound speed of non-interacting massless particles. Photons are the same speed of sound. Quarks would have the same speed of sound, because it doesn't much matter. The only scale in the problem is the Fermi energy in the problem. Mass goes out of the picture. So it is a pure number, 1/3, simply because you're in three dimensions. That's the physics of the 1/3 right there. And you can again go through all the mass, radius estimates, binding energy estimates, et cetera, for this equation of state as well. So these are the limits. You can't go beyond this. If the star was completely made out of quarks, these are the numbers. Any observation must lie below this. If stars were made completely out of causal matter, but with a, then the coefficient in front would be 1, and the numbers were given before. So everything should be underneath it. Okay. Now I go back to my ultimate energy density of cold matter picture. If I look at my scaling before, then you can plot the maximum mass as a function of the central mass energy density, because of established scaling. It turns out that Tolman had already done this in 1939. Now, you think you have done something new, but you look up the literature, and there is always somebody who has done it before. Very depressing. But in any case, Tolman 7 simply assume that the energy density behaves like this and solve the entire thing completely analytically. And he produced this curve, maximum mass as a function. I don't think he ever plotted this. We plotted this because we had a computer. He had just written it down. So this one is his solution. My maximally compact speed of sound equal to 1 lies underneath it, right? And if I make it 1/3, the curve that I get is this one, all right? And remember I showed you a picture of all the equations of state that everybody and his brother and sister have produced. Actually, I had to learn it and code it, and the results are all here. Everybody, this is a trend because of an analytic solution. This is for a given star. So this simply means the maximum mass and the central energy density for that particular equation of state is right there. Okay? Yeah. So I've collected a lot of those, and I've thrown a challenge to all my colleagues to produce me a star that goes above my line there. Okay? Or if not that one, goes above Tolman's 7 solution. If they do, then they have done something seriously wrong. I'm positive about it. They cannot get it there. Okay? But this picture tells me something else. Suppose the maximum mass of an observed star is 2 solar masses. In reality, we don't know that it is, but today the largest accurately measured mass is 2 solar masses, right? So I go there, I declare that as the maximum, true maximum mass. I go over here, if it was a completely this kind of an equation of state, namely completely quarks, the central density must be only this much. Right? I have no other option but to accept that physical conclusion. If it is completely causal, 2 solar masses, then it must be there. Notice that I have assumed that the speed of sound within the entire star is a constant, which is completely unrealistic. It cannot be. Right? It must vary. Its low density physics is different than high density physics, so the speed of sound will be definitely different. But I've definitely established the upper bounds on what it can be and what it cannot be. Okay. So that means it is really crucial to establish an upper limit to the maximum mass itself, which means that it is really crucial to measure very accurately masses that are even in excess of 2 solar masses, if it's possible at all. Then we are beginning to talk cookie, because then we can begin to really constrain models. So the implications for the pulsar, okay, I've restated it here in words. It is not possible, as I just said. Okay? If you think of any matter that we know and love, the speed of sound is not equal to 1 at all densities. It is not possible. But I'm setting myself an absolute upper limit in the sense that some strange thing that I do not understand about the physical world makes it so. Oh, he didn't even worry about s equal to 1. Tolman got it by simply assuming a functional form for the way the energy density behaves in the star. Because he could solve the TOV equations analytically. Okay? He did not even utter the word sound speed in his paper. Absolutely not. It's just that I noticed it, that the solution existed in the literature. Okay, so I'm restating it in words here. If the measured mass were to be taken as the maximum mass, these are the limits that you will have for the thermodynamic variables within the system. Then the job is to figure out whether strong interaction physics yields numbers that are below here and still produces a 2 solar mass star. Okay, this point was important for me because perturbative calculations were being done at chemical potentials that were way, way below credibility in some sense. Okay. So now the question came, well, does this mean that quarks cannot exist within stars at all? How can we do better than that? Now clearly, I must improve upon what I did at low density physics. I just simply said it must be, if the pressure is completely zero up to a transition density. Now I know by studies of low density matter, both involving electromagnetic interactions and strong interactions up to nuclear density, that that is not the case. And I do know what the equation of state up to nuclear density is, because I know what interactions between neutrons and protons are below subsaturation, below saturation density. So the equation of state there looks like this. Okay? And then I take the point of view that after a certain critical pressure, matter begins to dissolve itself into quarks, and I assume the extreme case that there's a first order phase transition, in other words there's a discontinuity in the energy density. And thereafter, it behaves in a linear fashion, but with a slope that I can vary, because I do not know the sound speed of interacting quarks, not non-interacting, interacting quarks after a certain density. It is also a simplicity to say that it is linear. It might have shapes, curves, and so on and so forth. But if I vary this sufficiently in a sufficiently reasonable range, going up to 1, which is the causal limit, I would recover everything that I had back before, and starting from 1/3, which cover the free particles case, then I will begin to get a sense of what is happening in the system, and I can trace a realistic curve between these constant curves. That's the idea. So then, this equation of state, notice, has two parameters, the sound speeds in quark matter, the critical pressure, which is necessarily by thermodynamics associated with the energy density itself, because there is a first order phase transition. So it turns out that, so now I map it, squared speed of sound in quark matter as a function of the discontinuity divided by the critical energy density itself. And the point to take from both of these curves is simply that masses in excess of 2 solar masses is possible to achieve even if quark matter exists within stars, provided it is not free quarks. They must be interacting because the squared speed of sound exceeds 1/3. It cannot be free quarks. That would be too soft. You need it to be stiffer than nearly non-interacting quarks. That's essentially the conclusion that you draw from both of these pictures, even if you choose two different models of nucleonic equation of state below the transition density. So that is beginning to make physical sense, at least, that it is possible to have exotica within stars, but they must be sufficiently interacting at least to support a 2 solar mass star, which requires a somewhat harder equation. Now, so far I've concentrated on mass. What about the size? What is the radius? If I go back and look at all the radii that were predicted from the previous equations of state, they still wander around. So if I have two constraints, then I can begin to get better. As I said, the radius measurements are not terribly reliable right now. This is a table of radii, and the error bars are quite large in most of the cases. And I'm not sure I believe the error bars quoted. So following the advice of my mentor, who always told me multiply every error bar by a factor of 2, I'm willing to say that more work is needed to make things much better than what we have at this point in time. So what are the avenues taken in order to measure radii? How can we get better? And how can we deconstruct a neutron star given observations of accurate masses and radii, or even masses and radii with some error bars? The point to note is the following, or the question to ask, is if I have on hand several observed individual masses and radii for the same stars. The mass of one star and the radius of another star measured very accurately has no meaning to me, not in this exercise. It has to be the same star, but I need several of them. If I have them, can I go backward? In other words, can I go from data to the pressure versus energy relationship? This is a familiar exercise even in scattering theory. If you have scattering observables, then using the data itself, can I go back to the potential or the interaction that caused that scattering, right? I mean, in condensed matter, it is very familiar. In nuclear physics, it is very familiar. And we can use the very same approach here. In other words, we reverse the problem. Clearly, data comes with error bars. And in adopting that procedure, we will probably end up with a band. But if we establish the possibility of it, then the error bars can be improved and the band begins to become a line. So this is not my original idea. This was already pointed out by Lindblom. In other words, you exploit the one-to-one correspondence between the pressure versus energy density curve to the mass versus radius curve. All right? So you can adopt two approaches. Given a set of numbers, you solve the TOV equations multiple number of times with assumed forms. Or you can reverse it, in other words, rewrite the TOV equations in such a way that they feature an enthalpic-like variable. If you remember, enthalpy is epsilon plus P over N. Yeah. Then you can now recast the equation such that R and M are now the dependent variable and P and epsilon are inputs in a way. It's possible to do so, and in fact it's a better way of solving the TOV equations than the other way around for the purpose on hand. And you can test it. At the moment we don't have masses and radii to precision. The same precision, let's say. So, but you say, well, I have an equation of state that I have constructed of some model or the other. I'll pretend that the masses and radii that I pick out of these are the real measured masses and radii. Just pick a few from this exercise and supply it to this scheme to see whether or not you can get pressure versus density. Because this scheme doesn't know about pressure versus density. It only knows about mass and radii. Right? And that test with a model can be done, and here is the model, the equation of state that I chose, and this is the pressure versus density relationship with an error that is extremely small. So this is only numerics at this point of time, right? How well can you solve these coupled differential equations, and can you reproduce it? And you can use any scheme that you wish, and you'll end up with only numerical noise. So in principle, it is possible very definitely. There is no ifs and buts about this, right? And this, although I picked only mass and radius, it could have been done for any two variables. All I needed was two variables, right? And so it has been established that this can be done. I'm coming to that. At this point in time, I gave only five masses and radii. But where the masses and radii were sufficiently different. And that becomes a tricky issue as we go along. Okay? And errors, associated errors. So I haven't told you precisely what the numerical scheme by which it was done. To say a few words about it, we took all possible paths, having achieved one location of mass and radius, but with physical limitations, such that when I took each path, it did not lead me to a relationship that was acausal. For P versus rho. It did not lead me to a relation that was less than one-third, because that is difficult to achieve. Some such, but based only on very general physical principles, no knowledge of interactions was inserted in it. Okay? So it is possible to do so. And here is a case in which we actually assigned some error bars, right? Everything is in geometrical units here. And you produce a band. Any of these will do. You cannot rule them out. So this sort of illustrates the influence of errors on the reliability of your results. Okay. But we only picked this one and one at very low mass. So there's already, you know, only two masses. So then comes the question, what if I, okay, let me come to the Irky points a little later, okay, because they will come to haunt us. So having the data sets on 8 cases, as I told you before, no single measurement of a mass and radius of the same star exist yet, not even accurately. No radius measurement of the very accurate measurement of masses exist yet. Okay, a really bad situation for pinning down the equation of state. But what my graduate students Steiner and Jim and Brown did was to pick whatever exists, you know, what is at this point in time, and they did this using a Bayesian analysis. And they come out with this inferred P versus epsilon relationships. Okay? And the M versus R relationships like this. So it's, to government accuracy, my favorite phrase, this is okay. Okay? At least the principle is okay. What we lack is really good data at this point in time. To come to your point, what if, I mean, look at this. This mass versus radius. The radius seems to be very nearly the same for all masses. This is somewhat of a peculiar situation, right? In fact, if you go back to polytropic equations of state, the polytrope of power of 1 equal to has this kind of a particular form. K rho to the 1 plus, yeah. K rho to the 1 plus 1 over gamma is 1, yeah. But in Newtonian physics, not in GR. GR begins to bend it, because Newtonian physics doesn't have a maximum mass. So now it depends, how many masses do I need? How different should the radii be? What are the requirements on the error ellipses as we go, and so on and so forth. But at least in point of principle, it is possible to do so. So some years ago, Jim and I showed the uncertainty in all the equations of state that used to exist, let's say, in 2001. This was the paper you were referring to, okay? It was, even at nuclear densities, let's say here, it was a factor of, let's say, from anywhere from 1 to 7 on a logarithmic scale, for God's sake. It was huge. So with this kind of an analysis, it is beginning to get smaller and smaller now, both because we harped and beat up on everybody, both observers and theorists, the things are beginning to become a little narrower. Okay, that's encouraging, but it's not done yet. So question, what is the status of simultaneous mass and radius measurements? How are people going about determining radii? Typically, the sources from which the information comes from are detection of thermal X-rays and optical fluxes from isolated and quiescent neutron stars. You measure the flux. If you know the distance to the star, which itself is a very difficult thing in astronomy, then you can get reasonable estimates. Type 1 X-ray bursts on neutron star surfaces. Some X-ray bursts occur, but after that, the star settles down for a long period of time before another X-ray burst occurs. So these are being modeled, and this, so a few cases of those belong to the cases that were chosen before. Moments of inertia I alluded to before, but no measurements exist yet. So these are all the paths that are being thought about, not that any real reliable data exists yet to write home about. And cooling following accretion episodes, pulse profiles, Love numbers from gravitational radiation, that induces quadrupole polarizability of the star itself because of the presence of the other star, neutrino signals from proto-neutron stars. All of these are hopeful avenues, not that any of these have panned out yet in any great success. Because of spin-orbit coupling, they have pulse detections that the spin orbit coupling induces yet another delay in it that is not normal. Okay. Latimer and Schutz have a rather nice paper about it. Mm-hmm. I should have said more about it, but I was going to do it around lunchtime, but didn't get around to it. I can show you later. It's in another talk. So, yeah, you need both of them. Both of them to be neutrons. I'll show you some pictures if I can finish this up. So, Bob Rutledge at McGill thinks that we can do better. He is a very positive guy, but he realizes there are always spanners in the works when you are not looking. But he has an interesting idea which I like. If you have, a detector with both good energy resolution and collection efficiency, just not counts is not enough. You also need energy resolution as Chandra has, and the collection efficiency as XMM Newton has, then it will be a fine and dandy world. Because what is stopping us now is if you look at the intensity of photons, then it goes like the cubic power of the energy upon kT, and again, the Planckian energy upon kT. Right? So there is a degeneracy here. You're only sensitive to the ratio of the energy of the photon upon the temperature. So it's a single variable. So I can change one or the other, and I'll still get the same function. So I have to break that degeneracy in observation, so somehow or the other. And his point is that if you look for cases, and he believes that in globular clusters, that is the cases, neutron stars have atmospheres composed only of hydrogen. Why, how? I leave it to you astrophysicists. If I try to ask Bob Rutledge too much, he gets so vigorous. I believe you, kind of thing. So, but his statement is that this pre-free opacity breaks this degeneracy, and therefore you have yet another function of the gamma energy. Therefore, if I'm able to measure the second derivative at the top very precisely, which means that I need very good energy resolution as well as number of counts, then we will be able to get both the neutron star mass and the radius of the star itself. Okay? I hope. I agree. But it's a hope. At least in terms of ideas, it smells right. I say all power to Bob. And LOFT may achieve this to some extent. I don't know. I hope so. But my money is on the double neutron star system yet, because Strohmayr at Goddard is beginning to devise a scheme in which he can get from a pulse shape analysis from X-ray binaries and binaries involving X-ray emitters and the white dwarf. But it is possible to get it, but he won't tell me more. He says he wants to actually get it published and then meet my demand on this one. So I would love to have one case. If one case happens, okay, then people will begin to get behind it. Then there will be more. I recall asking Taylor, of Hulse Taylor, when he got his Nobel Prize and when he was giving the talk, how many more cases do you think of pulsar masses we will get? And he was so pessimistic. Oh, it is so difficult. It is so difficult, was his answer. Now we have at least, this was what, 15 years ago that I asked, 84 was this. Yeah. And now we have at least 5 or 6 as well measured neutron star masses. You just have to do the first one, and then things will continue. So my summary would be, the 2 solar mass neutron star at least now sets absolute upper limits on the thermodynamic properties of the interior matter. If you give me 5 to 7 individual neutron stars, their masses and radii, I can construct the equation of state without recourse to theory. Then theory has to step back and make sure that this is the curve that they get and with what kind of interactions and so forth. The hunt for sub-millisecond pulsars must continue because that remains to be a puzzle. Why don't we have a case in which when it is theoretically alert, stars don't want to spin at that rate? Is it a selection effect? Whenever I ask any question, astronomers always say selection effect, and then I have to go home. Then I don't know. And precise laboratory experiments to establish near nuclear physics as well as we can. And principally put, we need more aggravation from data, because I think theory sort of is in place right now. Not theory, but at least the means to get to the curve that has been a long sought after curve. So that's roughly how much I had to say to you. Thanks. Well, that is not as much of a deal breaker as the composition of the atmosphere, because there is only so much atmosphere, as I talked about yesterday. The depth of the atmosphere is on the order of centimeters. Okay, you cannot put more atmosphere in because of the huge gravity that there is. Okay, so even if you make a factor of two error there, that is not going to be as much of a problem as the composition itself, because what matters for photon scattering is a photon scattering on hydrogen, or is it scattering on carbon? That is more important than the thickness of the atmosphere. Okay, the big factors come from the z squared. And the statement here is, which I'm not an expert of, that in globular clusters, most of these stars are hydrogen dominated. I wouldn't be able to give you an intelligent answer as to why that is the case, but that is the consensus from people. Say it again. Number one, and number two, also that since there are so many of them. Lost me completely. Yet another one? I have to talk to both of them because I have concerns. This one, okay? This comes from analysis of X-ray bursts. My problem with this kind of an analysis, and that's why I prefer a better way of doing it, is you sort of pile model upon model upon model of very many uncertain things before you come to this, okay? In the case of the X-ray bursts. What would be nice for me is a moment of inertia measurement, because it's in a clean environment, or observe a line on a star, a unique line. I would be, you know, supremely ecstatic about it, because then it is clean. So I don't know. I haven't heard this Bob's thing yet. He hasn't talked to me. I saw him pretty recently, but he hasn't told me yet. Isolated neutron stars, yes. I have to talk to him because, Jim, yeah, I have to sit with them and beat every one of them. But every one of them is bigger than me. That's the problem. Yeah, I know. See, I try to be as clean as possible, but you can only be as clean as possible when it is fully under your control. Yeah, somebody else. Yeah. Ozel et al, yes. Yeah, I've seen this. There's a lot of drama associated with this, yes. Yeah, so I know this one. This is the X-ray bursters and the radius settling down after it, the photospheric expansion and so on and so forth. Well, in the beginning, the full story is that in the beginning, Ozel made mistakes. You know, code as well as the solutions of the quartic equations that she sought, which was corrected by Jim and Andrew. Okay, so the results came out different. Even so, okay, everybody makes mistakes. Let's forget about it. But it's a correctable mistake. This was something on the order of 3 to 4 years ago. These were a little before that, in the very few first few papers. No, it was in the analysis. The mistake was made in the analysis, not the equation of state part, because they don't deal with the equation of state part. The radius values that were obtained were on the order of 2 kilometers, either this way or that way, depending upon who did the analysis. But notwithstanding all of that, my worry still is about a lot of one model on top of the other model. All these models contain some parameters that are completely undetermined. Okay? I mean, let me put it this way. Look at the number of blessings that the binary neutron star case has in the case of radio pulsars. Right? I mean, it is an overdetermined, obscenely overdetermined system. That's why they are able to get the masses so precisely. How many blessings do you want? Kepler, Newton, Einstein, Shapiro, I mean, it's pristine. Whereas the radius case is, 1%. Yeah, 2%, 1 to 2%. Even, 5%, I'll be generous. I will, when I'm proud about it, I'll come and say so. But at the moment, I cannot be sure that even my best friends can convince me that it's all very kosher. It's not there yet. Where is the Eddington limit for all these stars? Is it doing a super Eddington or sub Eddington? To what level? There are many, many things there. But that can be. That can mess you up. Yeah. Yeah. No. No, his point is right. What he's saying is, if the stars are very far apart, and even if they have a finite size, okay, all the measurements that you are looking at will depend only on their masses. It's as if they are point particles, but with endowed with a certain mass. You will not be sensitive to the radial distribution of matter within them, unless they come close. These are quite large distances. You have to come pretty close. Let's say, that's why in binary mergers, tidal disruptions do happen, right? That's how we get the Love number, the quadrupole polarizability, etc., etc. But you know, you are getting rather close in such a situation. Here, if you're a huge distances apart, and if the star is 10 kilometers, forget it. Yeah. Not yet. I don't think so. I mean, if you think about it, even though I have put out some of these proposals for binary mergers, what happens to radii and so on and so forth. Look. We haven't even measured the gravity waves yet. We have to learn a lot about it once we measure them, how to process it, the analysis, this, that, etc., etc. Getting the physics inputs of such detail that I'm talking about here is far away from that endeavor, I believe. Okay. But if I can put up, somebody was asking about moment of inertia. Let me see if I can dig it up. That's a, you were asking, right? Yeah, go on. Yeah, but even that has become the other one has stopped pulsing, unfortunately. That's right. No, we don't. Okay. It's always a correction. Because of the fact that I said none of them are at the limit of spinning, right? So you can calculate, for example, for slow rotation, you can already calculate by how much the star deforms. And unless they're coming very close to the Keplerian limit, they remain at the level of a couple of percent correction because of the angular momentum. But when you come close to it, they become significantly, even up to 10 to 20% corrections can be had. But none of these cases are such cases. Yeah. So. Yeah. I don't know. Thoughts have been. I don't know that I've sat down to actually work that number out for a recycle puzzle. I haven't thought about it in that particular way. The way I've also always been thinking is, you know, I have a mass, I have a, what do you call it, radius. Let me spin it. But given an equation of state, how fast can it go? And I've never been able to get it. Well, then we get a limit. Okay, I should backtrack. Then we get a limit, right? But then you go and look for the data, because there are several cases for which data exists. None of them close to the limit. That's the puzzle. I don't know. Maybe you and I can sit down and work it out. I haven't. There are other thoughts that there are, what do you call it, so-called R modes that develop within the star, and they are responsible. But the problem with this, once you begin to enter into the R mode instability region, there seems to be no real stopping them. That doesn't help. So there are several scenarios by which people are trying to stop them. Yeah, they talk about it, but papers still keep coming out. And well, opinions notwithstanding, thoughts are out there. Some people say, as you, that they're dead. Other people say, no, that's not clear. And that was one idea that was put out in the context of why things are not spinning at the rate that is allowed otherwise. But I don't know that I buy any of them at the moment, because this all seems a little contrived to me. There must be some other thing staring at us in the face, and we are not looking at it properly. I don't know. I don't think I can say anything intelligent about it at this point, except to note that that kind of a puzzle exists. But I'm trying to find this moment of inertia. It's an old form of the tech file with some other